From Pacifica Network, this is Democracy Now!
I spent 6 months at Guantanamo Bay as an Arabic linguist in support of intelligence gathering operations. I went there without any reservations whatsoever about what we were doing, but my experience convinced me that what we are doing at Guantanamo Bay is contrary to the values and principles we stand for as a nation.
Inside the Wire, a military intelligence soldier's eyewitness account of life at Guantanamo. Today we speak with former Army Sergeant Eric Saar. Among the abuses he says he witnessed, a female interrogator smearing what looked like menstrual blood on a Muslim prisoner. Then, today is the 35th anniversary of the Kent State shootings.
Just as President Nixon invaded Cambodia with U.S. troops, the National Guard then invaded the Kent State campus.
35 years ago today, National Guardsmen opened fire on a crowd of unarmed students on the campus of Kent State University.
This is when we're going to use every part of the law enforcement agency we hired to drive them out of Kent. We are going to eradicate the problem. We're not going to treat the symptoms.
On May 4th, 1970, four students were shot dead, nine others wounded. To this day, no one has been held accountable. Today, Kent State, the day the war came home. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 50 people have died in a large suicide bombing at a police recruitment center in the Kurdish city of Erbil. 150 people were also wounded, the deadliest attack in Iraq in over 2 months. The suicide bomber reportedly entered the recruitment center posing as a volunteer recruit. He then set off the explosives. Over 200 people have now died in Iraq since Friday when the Iraqi resistance launched a new wave of attacks. Today's bombing in Iraq came less than 24 hours after the swearing-in of the new Iraqi government headed by Prime Minister Ibrahim Jafari. The ceremony took place even though at least six cabinet seats remain open, including the key posts at the oil and defense ministries. Tension is rising inside Iraq over what role Sunnis will have in the new government. On Tuesday, most Sunni politicians, including the country's vice president Ghazi al-Yawar, boycotted the swearing-in ceremony. Yawar is the highest-ranking Sunni in the new government. The Washington Post is reporting the Iraqi resistance likely learned some of their bomb-making techniques indirectly from the U.S. Army. In 1965, the Army issued a detailed booklet on how to build and hide booby traps. The manual included detailed diagrams illustrating various means of wiring detonators to explosives. It also gave advice on the best locations for concealing deadly bombs. In 1987, Saddam Hussein distributed an Arabic version of the manual to the Iraqi military. The manual was translated at a time when the Reagan administration was supplying Iraq with military assistance in its war against Iran. One U.S. official estimated 10% of the bombs planted in Iraq use the pressure detonation techniques detailed in the U.S. document. On Tuesday, journalists across the globe marked World Press Freedom Day. Reporters Without Borders warned of the increasing threats facing journalists, especially in Iraq. The group reported 53 journalists were killed in action last year around the world. That's more than in any year since 1955. Meanwhile, reports are coming out of Iraq that Iraqi reporters are facing increasing threats and intimidation from Iraqi officials. According to the Knight Ridder News Agency, two newspaper editors in southeastern Iraq were jailed for several months for criticizing the local governor of Wasit province. Their newspaper was also shut down. In Bakuba, a TV cameraman has been detained since early April after he was arrested for filming inside a mosque. In Baghdad, a photographer was arrested for taking pictures of long lines at gasoline stations. The photographer, Ahmed Abed Ali, said, quote, "We've become hated because we say the truth. And the truth is that Iraqi police make a lot of mistakes." Another TV reporter says she's lost count of how many times Iraqi authorities have confiscated her cameras and smashed her tapes. In Britain, the families of 10 soldiers killed in Iraq are threatening to sue Prime Minister Tony Blair for waging what they describe as an illegal war and for lying to the public in the lead-up to the invasion. The group, Military Families Against War, say they would seek a judicial review of Blair's actions unless he agrees to a public inquiry into the legality of the war within the next 2 weeks. In addition, the group announced it's filing a complaint with the International Criminal Court in The Hague over the use of cluster bombs by British forces in Iraq. This comes as British voters are preparing to go to the polls for Britain's national elections Thursday. Blair is seeking his third term as prime minister. Iraq's been the main focus of the election, in part because of a series of leaked documents that have recently emerged outlining how Britain set the groundwork to justify the war. On Sunday, the London Times revealed it had obtained the minutes to a secret meeting that proves Blair had privately committed by July 2002 to wage war with Iraq. A secret briefing for the meeting said Britain and the U.S. had to, quote, create conditions to justify a war. Earlier during the British election campaign, it was revealed that Blair's own attorney general questioned the legality of the invasion. Here at home, support for the war in Iraq is at an all-time low. The latest CNN USA Today Gallup poll shows 57% of the country believe the war in Iraq is not worth fighting. Just 41% of respondents said the war has been worth it. The opposition to the war is also being felt at military recruiting centers. The U.S. Army revealed Tuesday during the month of April the Army missed its recruiting goal by 42%. The Army Reserve fell short by 37%. The Army has now missed its monthly recruiting goals 3 months in a row. In Afghanistan, 20 suspected insurgents and an Afghan police officer have been killed in the southeastern mountains in what's being described as one of the country's bloodiest battles in months. 6 U.S. soldiers were injured. On Monday, 34 people died northwest of Kabul after an arms depot exploded, blowing up a village. The explosives were being secretly stored in the home of a former Afghan commander. Meanwhile, the Pakistani government has reportedly announced it's arrested one of the highest-ranking leaders of al-Qaeda. The man, Abu Faraj al-Libi, was wanted for trying to assassinate Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf. He's believed to be one of the highest-ranking al-Qaeda members captured since Khalid Sheikh Mohammed in 2003. In Fort Hood, Texas, the sentencing for Private Lindy England has begun. England pled guilty for her role in the abuse of detainees at the Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq. A doctor testified in her defense that she was cognitively impaired due to oxygen deprivation at birth. The doctor said this resulted in a speech impairment, a reading disability, and her inability to resist peer pressure. Because of a plea bargain, England faces a maximum of 11 years in prison. At the United Nations, Iranian officials declared it would resume its plan to build nuclear plants despite U.S. opposition. The announcement came during the second day of a review of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Iran maintains its nuclear program is for peaceful means. It accused the Bush administration of using the fear of nuclear weapons proliferation to deny peaceful nuclear technology to developing countries. In Kuwait, women have faced another setback in their attempt to win the right to vote. The Kuwaiti parliament has effectively killed a measure that would have allowed women to participate in municipal elections for the first time. Here at home, the state of Florida announced Tuesday it will not continue to try to block a 13-year-old girl from having an abortion. Since the girl was a foster child, the state had been claiming that as her legal guardian, it had the right to deny her right to an abortion. Florida state law, however, allows minors to choose to have abortions. Howard Simon of the American Civil Liberties Union compared the state's action with that of the Terry Schiavo case. Simon said, quote, "You've got to be blind not to see a pattern here. The pattern is the state's hostility to the exercise of personal freedom when that personal freedom is not consistent with the prevailing ideology of the state government." The Bush administration has announced it'll soon close one-third of the regional offices run by the U.S. Civil Rights Commission. The commission currently has 6 regional offices. The offices in Denver and Kansas City will soon be closed due to budget cutbacks. And in Phoenix, a 24-year-old man died Tuesday after being shot by police with a taser stun gun. The man was reportedly fighting with a police officer at the time of the incident. The Arizona Republic reports at least 109 people have died in the United States and Canada following police taser strikes since 1999. Ohio by Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today by continuing our extensive look into the abuse and torture of prisoners held by the U.S. government since the onset of the so-called War on Terror. 3 years ago, most people in this country or around the world had never heard of Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, or Abu Ghraib prison, two places that have now become global symbols of the U.S. War on Terror. Last week marked the first anniversary of the breaking of the Abu Ghraib torture scandal. To date, no senior military officials have been held accountable for the systematic abuse of prisoners held by the U.S. military. Lawyers for the rank-and-file soldiers who've been prosecuted say their clients are cogs in a much bigger wheel that goes higher up in the chain of command. This weekend, the New York Times reported on a high-level military investigation into accusations of detainee abuse at the Guantanamo prison camp. While its findings fall far short in describing the extent of the abuse that human rights groups and released prisoners allege are taking place there, it did reveal some significant details. It concluded several prisoners were mistreated or humiliated, perhaps illegally, as a result of efforts to devise innovative methods to gain information. The report on the investigation is still a few weeks from being completed and released. The Times says it will deal with accounts by FBI agents who complained after witnessing detainees subjected to several forms of harsh treatment. The FBI agents wrote in memorandums that were never meant to be disclosed publicly that they'd seen female interrogators forcibly squeeze male prisoners' genitals, and they'd witnessed other detainees stripped and shackled low to the floor for many hours. This comes as a former U.S. Army linguist who worked as an Arabic translator at the U.S. prison camp at Guantanamo is speaking out. Eric Saar was stationed at the camp from December 2002 to June 2003, and he's just written a new book. It's called Inside the Wire, a military intelligence soldier's eyewitness account of life at Guantanamo, in which he describes a wide range of practices and techniques used by U.S. military officers at Guantanamo and condoned by senior officers. Eric Saar joins us now in Boston. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Eric.
Thanks for having me, ma'am.
It's good to have you with us. Can you start off by talking about why you went to Guantanamo?
I volunteered to go to Guantanamo Bay because I believed in the mission, to be honest with you, ma'am. I went there enthusiastically to serve my country and hopefully to use my Arabic skills to contribute to the war on terrorism and to help. I believed I was going to sit face-to-face with those who perpetrated and were responsible for the events of September 11th. And those who were planning future attacks against the United States.
And is that what happened when you went to Guantanamo?
Well, I went there with one expectation. What I found shortly after I arrived, and then I actually went through a process of realizing that my expectations really clashed with the reality of Guantanamo Bay. And it's not exactly what I found. There were a number of things that troubled me that ended up leading me to the conclusion that Guantanamo Bay, to me, represents a mistake and a failed strategy in this war.
You translated for the interrogators at Guantanamo?
I did. In the second half of my six-month assignment, I did serve as a translator in a number of interrogations.
You describe one scene of a female interrogator. Can you talk about what happened that day and start from the beginning?
That day, a technique was used in the interrogation booth where sex was used as a weapon to create a wedge between the detainee we were speaking with and his faith. For example, more specifically, the female interrogator I worked with that day sought to sexually entice the detainee. The logic behind that was that if he would be sexually attracted to her, he would feel unclean, and therefore, she believed in Islam, he would be unable to go back to his cell and pray. One thing she additionally did in order to humiliate him and also to make him feel unclean was wipe what was red ink on his face, but it was done in a way that he believed it was menstrual blood. All of this, again, was in an attempt to create this wedge between himself and his religion and not only was it ineffective, but I thought it was unethical.
Could you describe the events in detail? I mean, what happened? You were sitting in the room translating, and she walked in the room, the prisoner brought already there or brought in after?
I walked in with her. The prisoner had already been there waiting for a good period of time before we arrived. He was shackled to the floor and forced to hunch over. We were asking, telling him to be cooperative. She was saying that, you know, this is going to be unpleasant for you. After a break, we then returned to the interrogation booth, and that was when she started taking off her outer blouse, where she was wearing a tight T-shirt underneath, and she was touching herself and trying to arouse the detainee.
What was she saying to him?
She was saying, you know, it doesn't have to be this way. We could sit across a table and talk like adults, but I could tell. And then she went on to say, I could tell that you're aroused by me. How do you think Allah feels by you being attracted to an American infidel?
Did she describe her body to him?
She did describe her body, and she walked around and she rubbed her breasts on his back. And she was basically attempting to entice him.
What was her name?
I didn't write the book to go into specific allegations of what individuals did, but if I could take the opportunity to say this, one of the things that troubled me most about the camp was that the individuals there who were working were making, however misguided it was, were attempting to get information under techniques that were permissible by the command. So I really did not name anyone specifically for that reason, because I don't think anyone was operating outside of what the chain of command thought was permissible.
Hmm. Had you had this behavior that she was exhibiting described to you before? Did you know that this was going on in other cases?
I simply knew from other cases and colleagues that worked in interrogations and from seeing a skirt that hung up on a door that sex was used in other interrogations to create this sort of wedge between the detainee and his faith. But I really didn't, I hadn't sat in and seen one of these interrogations until that day.
And so in that case, as she was rubbing her body on him and she took off her outer blouse, what did she do then?
Well, we took a break, and then we went back. That was when she went and found a red marker to wipe red ink on her hands. We returned to the interrogation where she told him that she was menstruating and walked around and began to put her hands in her pants and walked around the detainee and then wiped the red ink on the side of his face and told him that it was menstrual blood.
Now, he was still shackled on the floor?
No, at that time, actually, when we returned to the interrogation booth, he was actually in a chair, but he was shackled. His ankles were shackled to the floor.
And as she smeared this ink on his face, what did he do?
He lunged from the chair, and actually he came out of one of the ankle shackles that was on, and the MPs had to come in, the guards had to come in and put him back in the shackles. And all of this, I'd like to say, was with someone that personally, based on the intelligence I had access to, was someone who was an individual that, to be honest with you, I hope never sees the light of day, but of course goes through some process of justice in order to face a just punishment. But at the same time, what convinced me and what was so troubling was that, first of all, this was ineffective. Secondly, even if it was effective, it was apparent to me that what we were doing there was not in keeping with the values we stand for as a country.
Now, all of this time, when she was saying things to him, things sexual in nature, you were the translator, is that right? You had to translate this into Arabic to him?
Yes, I was there for that.
Was he responding to you at all?
He was responding only to me, really, because he did not want to look her in the eye. So yes, he was responding to me.
Did you have any conversations with him separately? And how did you feel conveying this, speaking as her?
That's a good question. I actually felt it was one of the frustrations of dealing with certain interrogations, because as a linguist, you're to take on the role of the interrogator who was with you. So there was a conflict there in that I wasn't necessarily agreeing with what was taking place, but you had a mission at the same time.
And so when she took the red ink and smeared it on him, did she say to him, "This is menstrual blood"?
Yes, she said, "This is menstrual blood." And then she also said, "You know, have fun attempting to pray in your cell tonight when your water is going to be turned off." So they would turn off the water in his cell so he couldn't become ritually clean.
And his response?
His response was really nonverbal. The only thing I can make out that he said was some profanity. But other than that, he really was just despondent. And I guess that's the best way to put it.
We're talking to Eric Saar, military intelligence soldier's eyewitness account of what happened at Guantanamo, translator for the interrogators there. We'll be back with him in just a minute. General Penitentiary by Black Uhuru here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, as we broadcast on over 300 stations around the country, on Pacifica and NPR stations, on public access TV and PBS stations, as well as on both satellite networks, on Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, and on Channel 375 of DirecTV. We also video and audio stream at democracynow.org and are closed captioned for people who are deaf and hard of hearing. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue our conversation with Eric Saar, he wrote the book Inside the Wire, a military intelligence soldier's eyewitness account of life at Guantanamo, where he was an Arabic translator for interrogators there. He joins us from Boston. You were talking about the man that was being questioned in that case, a Saudi man. Why had he been picked up? Where had he been picked up, Eric Saar?
I can only say so much about this particular case because when I wrote the book, the book actually had to be vetted by the Pentagon in order to ensure that I wasn't revealing any classified information. But really what I'm just comfortable saying is that he was someone who we knew to have ties to terrorist organizations.
And as a result of the interrogation, did he reveal anything?
To my knowledge, Amy, I don't know that he ever did, but that was the last interrogation that I participated in, and I left the island shortly thereafter.
Because of your own feelings or your tour was done?
My tour was up, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. What about these hundreds of prisoners at Guantanamo? How many of them would you say are what the U.S. government calls terrorists?
Well, it's difficult for me to say because that definition seems so ambiguous, but I'll say this, that I was under the impression when I went there that I was going to be sitting face-to-face with hardened terrorists, meaning what our government has said is the worst of the worst. And I took that to mean those individuals that had extensive training from Al-Qaeda. Additionally, I thought that they were going to be men who had planned attacks against the United States, who were responsible for the events of September 11th, or who were planning future attacks against the United States. But what I found to be the case was that, and then I was also told that they were all enemy combatants, supposedly this new term, that were picked up on the battlefield with weapons, taken up, they had taken up arms against Americans. But we knew to be, I shortly found out after arriving there that that necessarily was not the case with a number of individuals. And we knew that there was a chunk of men there who we really had no idea how they came to us, or we did know that they were turned over by foreign governments or by the Northern Alliance. So we had no way to ascertain whether or not they had in fact ever taken up arms against them, or really even know how to corroborate their story.
Did you get to spend casual time with them outside of these extremely tense interrogation situations?
Actually, Amy, I had two jobs while I was on the island. The second half of my assignment there was when I worked on the intelligence team and worked with the interrogators in interrogations. But the first half of my assignment was actually as a linguist dealing, just as you mentioned, ma'am, with the day-to-day existence of the detainees on the cell blocks.
And what did they say to you?
You know, one of the things we were warned of early on was an attempt was not to be manipulated by the detainees, because they saw us as linguists, as their link to the outside world. So we did try to remain guarded, but at the same time, our day existed of having casual conversations with them, to be honest with you. Many of them told their stories, or what they said their stories were, of how they were innocent and they should not be held there. Some of them were lying to us. Some of them, I think there might have been some truth in what they were saying, but many of them were despondent and wanted to know when they were going to see an attorney or when the United States was going to charge them with something. Things along those lines were typical conversations.
Translating letters from their families?
We did. There was a unit that translated letters from the families going to the detainees. I really didn't have a very significant role in that.
You describe in your book what would happen when high-level politicians or officials would come through Guantanamo.
Right. What one of the things I learned when I joined the intelligence team was that when a VIP visit would take place, meaning it could be a general or it could be an executive from the senior government service, one of the intelligence agencies maybe, or even a congressional delegation, there was a concerted effort to explain to the interrogators that they were to find a detainee who had previously been cooperative and put him in the interrogation booth at the time when the VIP would be visiting and sitting in the observation room. Essentially, they were to find someone who had been cooperative, who they were able to sit across a table with and have a regular dialogue, and someone who had also had in the past provided adequate intelligence. And then they were to replay that interrogation for the visiting VIPs. And essentially, as an intelligence professional, this was insulting. And I don't think I was alone in feeling this way, to be honest with you, because in the intelligence community, your whole existence is in order to provide policymakers with the right information to make the right decisions. So that's really the existence of the intelligence community, to simply provide the right information. And this concept of creating this fictitious world, so Gitmo looked like one thing to those visiting when in reality it was something far different, completely undermined everything that we as professionals were trying to do in intelligence.
Were you able to convey that in any way to these people? And who were they? I mean, are we talking about senators?
What I had experience with, ma'am, was a number of generals that came to visit the island, and then there were executives from a few of the intelligence agencies, and then I also knew that there was a congressional delegation. I believe it was mostly staffers, but I could be incorrect about that, that also visited the island during my time there. And I was not able to convey that, and, you know, I have to accept responsibility for not having done so, but it really wasn't something that was hidden, I didn't believe. You know, I honestly, ma'am, I didn't know if I thought that the VIPs, when they came to visit, really believed they were seeing an actual interrogation. I almost find that hard to believe, because if they wanted to see something that might be typical, at least from the military's perspective, regarding what was going on in the interrogation booth, they might have been better off coming unannounced and asking to see an interrogation at 2 o'clock in the morning.
We're talking to a military intelligence soldier. His name is Eric Saar, and he's written about his experiences at Guantanamo, a book called Inside the Wire. You talk about hidden. the major general in charge of Guantanamo, Jeffrey Miller, was accused of hiding prisoners from the International Red Cross. Do you have any knowledge of that?
I don't know of the specific examples that we've cited in the past where they've referred to detainees as ghost detainees, meaning that they're not on the books at the camp. To me, I had no knowledge of that. But I did know that on occasion when a detainee would have his head shaved and occasionally his eyebrow shaved, we would move that detainee to an isolation cell so the Red Cross didn't have access to that individual.
Were dogs used?
Dogs were used on occasion, yes, ma'am.
How?
That's another thing that because the Pentagon vetted the book, I really can't speak outside of the scope of what I have written, unfortunately.
Were you concerned about that use of dogs?
To be honest with you, ma'am, one of the things I was trying to explain in the book is that, you know, I went to Guantanamo Bay with one expectation, and I, to be honest with you, I had no reservations whatsoever about any techniques we were going to use and about the lack of a system of justice for the detainees. But really what my experience was that over time, I came to the conclusion by the time I left Guantanamo that we're making a drastic mistake here. And what I saw as a whole was inconsistent with who we are and the values we represent as a nation.
As you were developing these feelings while you were there, you must have been having conversations with the other soldiers there. What was their response?
You know, a lot of the soldiers there shared some of my frustrations, but I don't want to say or act as though they all came to the conclusions exactly in the same way that I did or had the same conclusions. But at the same time, I think if you talk to individuals who had been there, you'll find someone who has frustrations with some elements of the camp. I mean, it was the way in which the camp was run, the gray lines that no one knew what was clearly defined as right and wrong, frustrated a number of individuals. And many people even were troubled by the fact that the files on a number of the individuals being held were extremely thin. We knew very little, about why they were there. And that bothered some people in thinking that as Americans, we enjoy one way of life and we say that our system of justice is something that we want to promote around the world and our democratic values are something that we stand up for. But at the same time, we're defying those very same values in Guantanamo Bay.
After the situation, the interrogation that the female interrogator performed on the Saudi prisoner. Did you have a conversation with her? Did you raise your objections to her?
I did not. Actually, as soon as the interrogation was over, I left the interrogation booth and we didn't speak again. But one of the things I want to be very clear about is I didn't go forward and say anything to anyone, and I wish I had. But at the same time, ma'am, I really had no reason to think that what took place that night was outside of the scope of what the command had deemed permissible. So truly, all I did was request from someone who handled the scheduling of the interrogations not to be used in the interrogation booth from that point on. I think I had about a month left on the island.
Eric Saar, was the words Geneva Conventions ever used at Guantanamo?
One time, ma'am, I could say when we were talked to regarding the Geneva Conventions, and it was a meeting that I described where our leaders of the intelligence group explained to us that the Geneva Convention does not apply at Guantanamo Bay, and they gave us reasons as to why they rationalized that it did not, and that now the detainees we should understand, of course we knew this beforehand, but this was in a meeting where they were explaining to us the reasons why. We should understand that these individuals were enemy combatants and to be treated as detainees. And one of the frustrations regarding that is someone who interacted with and had friends who were interrogators is that the essence of their training, ma'am, when they go through school is that you are taught a couple things about the Geneva Convention. First of all your training is under the umbrella of the Geneva Convention. And you're told that you never violate the Geneva Conventions as an interrogator because for two reasons. Number one, it's illegal. And number two, they're taught that it's ineffective. And if you need to use tactics outside of the scope of the Geneva Conventions, you're going to get bad intelligence anyway. But somehow, no one quite understood how it was just determined that now those rules don't need to apply. Plus, there's limited, if no training, for how these new rules or should be implemented in the interrogation booth, and what is the rationale for why previously I was taught as an interrogator, or one of my colleagues was taught, that these techniques wouldn't work, but now we're saying that maybe they will.
Did you ever have fights with other soldiers there over your feelings about what was happening?
No, ma'am, I didn't. And to be honest with you, the conclusions that I drew was really a process for me. I mean, there were things that frustrated me along the way that I saw, but it's not as though during week three of my time at Guantanamo Bay, I came to the conclusion that, wow, this is a terrible place and we should never be doing this, because there was also that internal battle of me saying, look, maybe, I was saying to myself, maybe this is what's necessary in the war on terrorism. Maybe these are the steps that we need to take to protect ourselves. And it wasn't until the end of my time there that I really reached the conclusions that I drew that it's not necessary and the techniques are ineffective and it's not in keeping with who we are.
Eric Saar, do you think that the abuse was creating terrorists?
I think, Amy, that what I witnessed at Guantanamo Bay was, on a practical level, counterproductive in the war on terrorism. Because, in fact, as we go throughout the Arab and Muslim world and say that we're going to promote values of democracy and justice and human dignity, but at the same time defy those very same values in Guantanamo Bay, I do think, in the long run, it could produce more terrorists.
When the pictures of Abu Ghraib broke, it was a year ago, April 2004, what was your response? You'd been out for about a year.
Actually, it was just that I was out of Guantanamo Bay for a year, but I was just finishing my time in the Army. But I was saddened, to be honest with you, ma'am, because I'm not someone who's left the Army, and although I might be portrayed this way in the coming days, I'm not someone who thinks the Army is a terrible organization. To be honest with you, I think, by and large, the men and women I served with, Americans should be proud of every day because of the sacrifices they make. But it saddened me as a soldier because, obviously, it hurt our reputation. And I also realized that some of the things we're discussing about Guantanamo Bay might hurt our reputation. But I'm also led to believe, based on my convictions, that one of the great things about our country is that we try to correct our mistakes and learn from them. And that's one of the things that's so great about our democracy. In fact, the very fact that I'm able to write this book is a testament, I believe, to how great we really are. So it saddened me that it hurts our reputation, but I think it's also something we can recover from.
Did you see any kids at Guantanamo?
I knew that there were children at Guantanamo Bay.
Are they still there?
I wouldn't be able to say that. I believe, based on reports that I read, that some of the younger children are not there anymore. But because I left in 2003, I couldn't say.
How old were they and how many?
I don't remember their exact ages, to be honest with you, ma'am, but because they actually didn't. The individuals I'm thinking of that were kept at a place outside of Camp Delta were not Arabic speakers. So I had colleagues of mine who were linguists who worked with them, but I wasn't privy to exactly how they were interacted with.
Did you ever talk to the Red Cross there and raise any concerns?
No, we were under strict guidelines to never speak with the Red Cross.
Even if they tried to talk to you?
Exactly, even if they tried to talk. We were definitely, the orders were very clear to stay far away from them.
Do you wish you did now?
You know, I wish I had said something to someone, to be honest with you. I don't know who would have been the appropriate person to talk to. I've been told that I should have gone to my chain of command, but as I've tried to say, I wish I had done that, but I don't think the command would have been surprised by anything that I had said.
Why were you told not to speak to the Red Cross?
I don't know the exact reasoning behind it, but I think they wanted to ensure that the Red Cross did not have access to anyone who knew of the intelligence situation on the island.
Do you think Guantanamo should be closed?
Well, I don't know. I'll tell you this, ma'am. I do know that there should be some drastic changes, and there, in order to be in keeping with the liberties we enjoy as a country, if we're going to somehow portray those values around the world, I do think we need to have some system of justice. And the fact that there's a number of individuals there that have had no access and no way to even defend themselves, I think, is not in keeping with the values that we enjoy as Americans. So as we go about defending ourselves, I don't think it's logical to defy those values in the process.
Eric Saar, I want to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, ma'am.
Eric Saar has written the book Inside the Wire, a military intelligent soldier's eyewitness account of life at Guantanamo, speaking to us from Boston. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, 13 seconds, 35 years ago today, the day that Kent State students were killed as the Kent State National Guard opened fire on a protest. Stay with us. Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Young. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. It was 35 years ago today that the Kent State shootings happened. On May 4th, 1970, U.S. National Guardsmen opened fire on a crowd of unarmed students on the campus of Kent State University in Ohio. The guard fired at least 67 shots in roughly 13 seconds. Four students were killed, nine others wounded. To this day, no one's been held accountable. Today, on the 35th anniversary, we remember the Kent State shootings. At the time, President Richard Nixon had just escalated the Vietnam War and launched the invasion of Cambodia. Across the country, college campuses erupted in protest. At Kent State, a large demonstration was held on May 1st in the university grounds, with another planned for May 4th. Students clashed with police, and tensions were high throughout the city. On May 2nd, Kent City Mayor Leroy Satram declared a state of emergency, and later that afternoon asked Ohio Governor James Rhodes to send the National Guard to Kent State. That evening, students held a large demonstration. The campus ROTC building was set on fire. The National Guard entered the campus for the first time, set up camp directly on the university grounds. They used tear gas to disperse the crowd. Many arrests were made. By Sunday, May 3rd, Kent State campus was occupied by nearly 1,000 National Guard. Governor Rhodes held a news conference that day, which many say served only to provoke and increase the existing tension.
We've seen here at the city of Kent, especially, probably the most vicious form of campus-oriented violence yet perpetrated by dissident groups. They make definite plans of burning, destroying, and throwing rocks at police and at the National Guard and the Highway Patrol. This is when we're going to use every part of the law enforcement agency of Ohio to drive them out of Kent. We are going to eradicate the problem. We're not going to treat the symptoms.
And these people just move from one campus to the other and terrorize the community. They're worse than the brown shirt and the communist element and also the night riders and the vigilantes. They're the worst type of people that we harbor in America. And I want to say that they're not going to take over a campus.
General Del Corso, how long do you expect to keep the guard in Kent?
Well, I'll answer that till we get rid of them.
Ohio Governor James Rhodes speaking on May 3rd, 1970. The next day, May 4th, a protest scheduled to be held at noon on the University Commons. An estimated 3,000 people gathered for the rally. The National Guard ordered the crowd to disperse and began to fire tear gas. Students responded by some throwing rocks, chanting pigs off campus. In an attempt to disperse the crowd, a group of 70 National Guard troops advanced on the protesters with fixed bayonets and with their weapons locked and loaded. The guardsmen soon found themselves trapped on an athletic practice field, which was fenced on three sides. What happened next left an indelible mark on the history of this country. To tell the story, we turn to an excerpt of the documentary Kent State, The Day the War Came Home. It includes interviews with students, with National Guard. This begins with the former Kent State student, Joe Lewis.
Suddenly, and without any warning, several of them in the lead wheeled and leveled their rifles back towards my direction. I took it to be a threatening gesture, and so being 18 and foolish, I gestured back at them by raising the middle finger of my right hand.
And at this point, it's like a film playing in slow motion for me.
I heard the word fire. I believe that that was a situation of hold your fire, do not fire.
At that point, the guardsman on my right fired his weapon.
Within, again, milliseconds of that single report, the volley itself began.
Started screaming, they're shooting their guns, they're shooting their guns.
It hit us all, I'm sure, at that moment. They're trying to kill us.
I had a person targeted. I pulled the slack out of the trigger.
I assumed that we were firing warning shots, and I fired my weapon in the air.
I jumped on the ground, praying I wouldn't get hit.
Hundreds of people were falling on the ground. And I believe that many of them were being hit.
There was one tree near me, which was right in the line of fire. And as I got behind the tree at the last second before my arm reached the safety of the tree, that's when I was hit.
Next thing I know, I got hit just below the shoulder blade in the back, on the left side.
That person that I had targeted was standing in front of me yelling, shoot me, mother, shoot me.
Everybody else is running away, and there's this one male coming towards us. His right hand was in the upward position, giving an obscene gesture, and his left hand was somewhat behind his back.
My mind was racing. My mind was telling me that this is wrong, that this is not right.
I wasn't giving an obscene gesture for the first time that day, but I wasn't screaming, and I wasn't moving.
This is not right. This is not right. This is not right.
At that point, I felt that I was in jeopardy, and I fired on the individual. He dropped.
And I believe someone said that they heard me say, oh my God, they shot me.
The next thing that I remember was there was an order from the rear of where we were, someone yelling to cease fire, which it stopped immediately.
The shooting lasts a total of 13 seconds. A total of 67 bullets are fired. One of those bullets has passed through the wrist of Alan Canfora.
It was kind of an eerie calm, just for a split second. We waited to hear if there were any more bullets that were going to be fired, and there were none. And then all you could hear in the air after that was screaming, crying, people shouting for ambulances.
And then we were told to return to the commons area, and that's when we went back down the hill and back across the commons to where we originally started at our staging point.
We had no clue as to how many people were hurt. Our fear was that it was awful.
Dean Kaler lays face down on the practice field. A bullet has passed through his spine, paralyzing him for life.
That's one thing I'll never forget about that day. Just seeing the looks on the faces of the students who were standing over me, not knowing that there was 12 other people out there shot. Four of them bleeding profusely, lying dying on the ground.
Joe Lewis lays bleeding with two bullet wounds, one through his abdomen and one through his left leg.
I thought to myself, well, this could be it. And I was afraid that I was going to die. And so I made an act of contrition to say that I was sorry for my sins. And
I saw a girl being carried into the yard at Prentice Hall, and I ran over there with this rag thinking I could help someone. And I looked down, and it was Sandy. Sandy was a friend, and she was so blue and gray. She had been shot through the jugular vein, and I didn't even recognize her.
And she was killed within seconds as she walked to her class, 400 feet away from the triggerman.
I remember the first person I saw was Jeffrey Miller, and he was lying very still.
One of the first to reach Jeff Miller's body is 14-year-old runaway Mary Vecchio, who only a short time earlier had been protesting with him on the commons.
I thought it was Alan. I mean, I'll never forget running toward the body of Jeff Miller, thinking it was Alan. And how I felt when I looked down and saw Jeff lying in this pool of blood, and there was so much blood.
And we walked over toward another cluster of people, and they were standing around Bill Schroeder.
Bill Schroeder was an ROTC military science student. He was the all-American boy. He was not a protester, not a radical, not part of the demonstration. He was just there watching.
She said, "Barry, I'm hit." And I had no idea what that meant at the time. I mean, in split seconds, I knew, but I didn't know. It couldn't be. It's impossible. What do you mean you're hit? As I went to stroke her cheek, I saw a smudge of blood on her cheek. And it had come from my hand, which was underneath her. So I realized at that point she had been shot in the back and she was bleeding. And as it turns out, she was dying.
In the moments after the shootings, faculty marshals are told by General Canterbury that the commons must be cleared within 15 minutes, or he will send the guard out again.
We were sitting sort of in rows on this little slope, and Glenn Frank was in front of us pacing back and forth, and he was crying, and he was talking very passionately.
I don't care whether you've never listened to anyone before in your lives. I am begging you right now, if you don't disperse right now, they're going to move in and there can only be a slaughter. Would you please listen to me? Jesus Christ, I don't want to be a part of this.
Finally, the sense that something, that this terrible thing had that had happened to these other people could happen to us, finally got through.
Students slowly begin to disperse. The commons are eventually cleared and the wounded rushed to the hospital. County Prosecutor Ronald Kane orders the campus closed and evacuated as news of the shooting finds its way to the students' families.
Got into my apartment, and I figured I'd better call Jeff and tell him to get out of there, that, you know, he doesn't have to hang around during all that trouble.
So I called the, tried to get through to Ravenna Hospital, and I couldn't. I finally got a hold of a telephone operator, and she got me through, and I identified myself. I said, I'm Mrs. Krause, and I want to know how my daughter is. I want to talk to the administrator.
I called his number, and it rang and rang, and then a young man answered, and I said, let me speak to Jeff. And he said, who is this? And I said, it's his mother. And he said, he's dead.
Well, he came on the phone. He said, oh, she was DOA. And that's how I found out my daughter was gone.
An excerpt of the documentary Kent State, The Day the War Came Home, directed by Chris Trifo, produced by Ron Getz, won a 2001 Emmy Award. 10 days later, on May 14th, 1970, two students at Jackson State University in Mississippi were shot dead. Police fired hundreds of shots, killing 21-year-old Philip Lafayette Gibbs and a high school student named James Earl Green. 12 other Jackson State students were struck by gunfire. Today at Kent State University is the 35th anniversary commemoration. The theme of this year's event, Tell Me, Father, Did They Aim? That does it for today's program. You can go to our website at democracynow.org to get more information and look at the events of today. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdelkaddous, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Richin, Jeremy Scahill, Mike DeFilippo, and Ryan Abernathy are our engineers. I head to Louisville, Kentucky today, tomorrow, in Bloomington, Indiana. We'll be broadcasting there on Friday. On Friday night in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and then on Saturday night in Minneapolis, Sunday as well. Then back here broadcasting in New York on Monday. DemocracyNow.org is our website where you can go to get our daily digest and sign up for our daily digest email alerts. Democracy Now!, this is your program. Encourage others around the country. If they'd like to bring Democracy Now! To their radio or television station, just go to our website as well. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.